This is an interview with Brenda Hall. Today is February 12th, 2014, and this is Adam Chile conducting the interview. So, just to get us started off, I'm wondering if you can tell me how you got interested in glacial geology.
From the very beginning?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I was at a very boring family reunion when I was about 10, and they had a great library, so instead of hanging out with the 70-year-olds, I hid behind a chair and read a book on glaciers. And that, I think, is what really started my interest in the subject, and I decided to become a geologist while in high school, and I always wanted to be a glacial geologist. I already knew that at that point.
Did you have any family members that were academics so that you knew?
No, not at all. Well, unless you count a great-great-uncle. Mm-hmm. Who was a physics professor here, actually, a very long time ago. But in general, no. My family have all been teachers, but none of them scientists.
Interesting. Wow. So from such an early age, you knew.
It's quite strange that it happened that way. But I definitely remember the moment just... It was one of these reunions that you go to that you don't know anybody, and your grandparents barely even know anybody, and, mm-hmm. and so they had a library.
So when you went to college, you studied geology?
Yes, yeah. So, yeah, I did my undergrad at Bates, mm-hmm. and so I studied geology and Russian, actually.
Uh-huh.
It was a double major.
Mm-hmm. So. And what did you do after completing your undergraduate?
I got my graduate degrees here, working with George Denton.
Master's and PhD.
Master's and PhD. So I've actually been here a very long time, much longer than I've been on the faculty.
Mm-hmm. When was the first time you went to Antarctica?
1990. Yeah.
How did you expect it would be, and was it different when you got there?
I had no idea what to expect at all. And so, yeah, so it wasn't different or anything. I had really no expectations. I didn't know much about Antarctica when I first went. Mm-hmm. When I got the position as a graduate student, I didn't even really understand that there was dry land that wasn't covered with ice in Antarctica. So the whole thing was new and really exciting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that you had a bit of learning to do on your first trip.
Yeah, I mean, it was... It was definitely a learning experience, not just the science. I mean, the science was... Every day was learning as far as the science. And The way my first trip went was I went down without my advisor. So George came later. And so I left in October, and I had a few days with another graduate student. He sort of got me started.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was on my own for 3 months. And so every day was learning as far as science, but it was also learning in terms of having to be responsible for a camp. Because we had our own tent camp, so it was me and a field assistant, usually just the two of us.
Two people. How far? I assume you started at McMurtro.
Yep.
And then what? You hiked off with another field assistant?
We were put into the field by helicopter.
Oh, I see.
Yep. And so at that point, there were five of us. And then the other graduate student left with two of the field assistants to go form another camp somewhere. And so it was me and a field assistant, not only doing the science, but managing the camp, which included, you know, just the basic living in that sort of environment, which in October is pretty darn cold in Antarctica.
Managing the camp.
Well,
so.
There's no water, so you have to get ice from the glacier to melt water, and the stove doesn't want to light because it's too cold, and you have to worry about wind blowing away the camp, and And then you have to call in every day. And if you don't call in, you know that they're going to mobilize this search and rescue if you miss your check-in by, you know, even a few minutes. And you have to call for helicopters when you need them. So there's a whole bunch of sort of logistical stuff that that I sort of learned very quickly.
Sure.
Yeah.
How far were you from help? How far of a helicopter?
Oh, I mean, we weren't in a very remote area from Antarctica. It's about, we were probably 50 miles from McMurdo.
Yeah.
So maybe an hour helicopter flight. Yeah, but you definitely have the feeling of being the only one out there in October anyway.
I would think so.
In the particular location where we were, we didn't see other people very often. We didn't see helicopters very often.
Yeah. So, can you walk me through a typical day during that time?
During that first year?
Sure.
Well, we had to get up and do our morning check-in by 7:30, so that always got us out of bed. And then usually the first one up lit the stove and got snow melting or ice melting for water. In October, it took a long time to get going in the morning because all of the food was frozen, not just the water. And so anything that you wanted to eat had to be thawed.
Such as?
Canned fruit or even like peanut butter would be frozen, jam would be frozen. I mean, just everything.
Yeah, how cold was it?
I don't know. It was cold.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's October. We were up about 3,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And it warms up quite a bit. And as I said, it was 40 degrees when I left here a couple weeks ago. So, so we'd do that, and then we'd go out the whole day, and usually involved either walking, making maps of things, or digging. We dug a lot of holes to look at what the sediments looked like under the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And so these were sort of standard 1 meter square, 1 meter deep holes that we would dig through the deposits. With pick and shovel, so we got really good at digging. We dug something like 400 holes that year. So
wow,
yeah,
physical stuff. Huh?
A lot of physical stuff. Yeah.
Tell me about the mapping you did.
So we were interested in understanding how the alpine glaciers there had changed over time,
mm-hmm.
and so we were looking at older deposits from those glaciers,
mm-hmm.
and you can identify the landforms in the field. And so we had aerial photographs that we then marked the different features on those photographs until every surface of the air photograph had some designation as to a landform or sediment type.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also did some work collecting samples for different dating techniques. And this mainly were volcanic samples that we used for argon dating,
mm-hmm.
which were allow us to get some ages on the deposits.
So digging holes and mapping.
And mapping, collecting rocks, yeah.
Collecting rocks.
Yep.
And that was the first year.
Yep.
Did you did you encounter any serious physical hardships during that year?
I mean, not out of what you would expect from digging holes and walking all day and being cold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Now, speaking just in terms of all of your trips to Antarctica, did you ever have any close calls where maybe you or somebody on your team nearly got injured or did get injured?
So I've been pretty fortunate. I've had a couple instances I have not liked, but I wouldn't call them close calls at all. But for example, that first year, the other graduate student, one of his field assistants, tore his knee and had to be evacuated. So that was within our larger group. It wasn't at my camp or with me at all, but I knew the person who had, you know, who had to end up leaving
mm-hmm.
the Antarctic.
Mm-hmm.
But in my group, no, we've been lucky. We haven't had any real injuries or anything.
Yeah, yeah. Did you ever have any moments where it just wasn't fun and you didn't necessarily want to be there?
Well, I've had a couple of moments in helicopters that I've not been too thrilled about, but it turned out okay in the end.
Can you tell me about one of those
Oh, I mean,
times?
they're nothing really serious. I mean, George is the one who's had the serious problems with helicopters, as he probably told you. No, I've just had a couple instances where don't want to say I didn't have a lot of confidence in the pilot, but I might have known the local area a little better than they did, and I wasn't comfortable with some of the decisions they were making. But probably the closest thing we've had to actually crashing was when we were landing, and that was we landed on a snow patch. The snow patches are sometimes hollow, and the snow patch did collapse the back of it, and so our tail nearly hit the ground.
So
But
you got jerked back a bit.
we got jerked back, and those were Navy helicopters at the time, and they always had a crew member, and the crew member was hanging out, and you hear this frantic up, up, up sort of thing, because he's calling the thing for the pilot, because the pilots can't see. I mean, the pilot's looking straight ahead. At least that's how the Navy pilots were trained to do it, and they always had a crew member hanging out the side, sort of telling them where to land and how far down they had, and so we had quite a frantic up, up, up sort of.
I'm sure that didn't inspire much confidence.
No, well, I mean, I knew what was happening at that point, and there's nothing you can do about it. So, but.
Tell me, I wonder if you can share any stories about the camaraderie that you might have had there in Antarctica. I mean, you're in a remote place and you're camping with a person for long periods of time.
My best friends are all people I've worked with in the field in Antarctica. I mean, I have a lot of colleagues that I work with, a lot from different universities or whatever, or former graduate students, and they're definitely my best friends. And it's just, I don't know, you just have a common experience like that, and especially if there's been any hardship or whatever, you just, yeah, I mean. I've been fortunate in that I've had very good people to work with over the years, and that's not just my colleagues, but my students as well. I mean, you hear stories sometimes about groups that are in the field that maybe they didn't all get along, or there was some rift or whatever, and I've just been really lucky not to have that, and we've just it's fun. It's a lot of fun being in the field with people.
What was the most physically daunting day you had down there?
In the Antarctic.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to say. I mean, a lot, they all blend together. The Antarctic in general is probably not as physically daunting as some of the other field work I do because we have helicopters. And so any really heavy lifting is by helicopter, whereas other places we go in the world, sometimes we have to do all the carrying ourselves. Probably the hardest project I've had physically in the Antarctic is when we've been coring lakes. So I had 3 or 4 seasons where I was coring lakes, and the lakes are miserable to cross, a lot of them, because they have very uneven surfaces with up to maybe 1 meter or so of relief and hollows. So they're like perched water tables on the lake ice that then freeze, and so you walk on them and then you crash through about knee deep in water. We had to haul all of our gear over that, which required us to flag a route and do a little bit of construction on the ice itself. And then the coring is just difficult. It starts off by drilling through 5 to 8 meters of ice with a hand auger, and then deploying some sort of coring device, either with or without rods, to the bottom of a lake, which might be 70 meters down, and then pounding it in and then pulling it back up. Even with a winch, it's pretty rough getting it back up sometimes. So that definitely was the hardest, physically hardest Antarctic season. One of those would be. I think I did permanent damage to my hands and stuff from that, just because we did a lot of pulling with ropes and yeah, it was a rough season.
When you were out there in Antarctica and going to these remote places that few people have ever really seen, did you ever think of yourself as an explorer?
No, I haven't. I guess I see myself as a scientist. And yeah, no, I've never seen myself as an explorer.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I've been a lot of places not many people have been before.
Have you read any of the earliest accounts of Antarctic explorers?
Yes, I've read, well, virtually anything I get my hands on, but I've read all the early accounts by Shackleton's group and Scott's groups, and I like reading the diaries of some of the scientists on those projects, because I guess I feel a bit of a bond with some of those early scientists, because they're making observations, and a lot of them were making the first observations on an area. And places I've been, there have been times where I've made the first observations of an area, of the geology of it anyway. And I've worked in some of the same places that these early scientists worked, and I could still use their field notes even after 100 years. You could still see what they were mapping and how things have changed over time, and you can read their accounts of how they were living, and it's very similar in some ways to how we live.
Mm-hmm.
Our group tends to be, I would say, a bit of old-fashioned, but we still live in tents out in the field. A lot of groups, especially those who work in the Dry Valleys area, have switched to living in huts or flying in from McMurdo on a nearly daily basis. And so there aren't that many groups in the near field anyway, in the sort of the McMurdo area, where people still camp. And so... Yeah, we still do, and it has some similarities to the early groups there, except we're not sledging. we're flying in by helicopter, which is a whole lot easier.
Mm-hmm. And then when you travel from your camp, do you have snowmobiles? Do you go on foot?
So I work both close to McMurdo, well, relatively close. The Dry Valleys are considered close. I mean, they can be anywhere from 40 minutes to a couple hours from McMurdo by helicopter. In those areas, I'm walking. We do mostly all walking. We work in the dry areas because we're interested in the geology.
Right.
In some of the more remote places I've gone, we've been put in by a small airplane, and then we have skidoos, and we travel on the glacier from site to site, or at least to our campsite from the airstrip. So,
where else have you done research?
So I've worked in Greenland quite a bit, and also in southern Chile. Those are the areas I've worked the most. I've done, you know, odds and ends and bits and pieces in various places, but those are that in the Antarctic are the main places I've worked. As far as the Antarctic, I've worked all over the Antarctic as well, including some of the sub-Antarctic islands, the South Shetlands. I'm going to the Falkland Islands in a month to do some work.
Neat. Cool.
So.
You mentioned that actually the field work you did outside Antarctica was more demanding. So I'm assuming you meant Greenland or southern Chile.
Well, both, really. I mean, they're all demanding their own ways, but I would say probably the first Greenland's, not the first Greenland, but one of the Greenland seasons I did was probably more physically demanding, and that's because we just had so much gear. It was an area of East Greenland where the terrain is pretty rugged. The walking is not easy. It's all boulders that you have to sort of teeter and balance across. And we were coring a number of lakes. Lake coring is hard. I think that's sort of a general theme. The hardest Antarctic season was lake coring, and the hardest Greenland season also is lake coring. But this we were doing from boats or inflatable rafts. And we just had a lot of gear. And the lakes were maybe as much as a kilometer apart, up over quite a bit of relief. And we just had a lot of gear to carry.
Sure.
Had to make multiple trips. And it was rigorous.
Mm-hmm.
You are in very good shape when you return.
I imagine so. What do you think has been your most important contribution to climate science?
I think it's an understanding of the history of the Antarctic ice sheets and an understanding of the time scale on which they have changed, and their timing relative to other things that have happened in the world. Which has allowed us to really change our ideas about what causes the Antarctic ice sheet to grow and shrink, which is important for sea level. The real reason why people are so interested in the Antarctic ice sheet really is sea level prediction. And understanding what causes that ice sheet, particularly the western part, to advance and retreat is really important in understanding what future sea level change might be. And so a lot of the work that I do has been focused on trying to understand the behavior of that ice sheet to get a sort of a long-term history of it and to figure out what causes it to advance or retreat. Is it changing sea levels around the world, which has been one idea over time, that when sea level drops, this ice sheet just expands?
Mm-hmm.
Is it changing ocean temperature, which melts the underside of the ice sheets? If that's the case, then we're probably in big trouble because the ocean temperatures are rising, and so forth. There are various other things that you can look at as well, but that's really the area of research, I think, where I've made the largest contributions so far. I have a wide variety of research interests, but that's probably the one I've devoted the most time to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when did you become a member of what was then the Quaternary Institute?
Well, that's hard to say exactly. As I did my my graduate work here, even though I was in the Earth Science Department, I was really in both departments. And so I've been involved with the Institute and the Institute faculty and people involved in it since I first came here in 1990. Went on all the Institute trips. Was really a part of it at that time. I became a faculty member in, I think, 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you obviously had heard of the Institute while you were doing your undergrad. I'm just curious why you decided you wanted to do your graduate work here.
I came to work with George Denton.
So you had read George's work?
Right. Or he was recommended to me. And yeah, he is the primary reason I came to the University of Maine. I'm from Maine, and so I was definitely happy to be able to do graduate work here.
Mm-hmm.
But George is definitely the primary reason why I came.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think the Institute has changed since you first became involved with it?
Well, it's changed in a number of ways. It's gotten much, much bigger. I mean, that's really the obvious change. When I started, it was probably 10 faculty members. It was 2 geologists, 2 paleoecologists, 2 archaeologists, a glaciologist, an ice sheet modeler, and a marine paleo person. And then there were some people in other departments who were very loosely linked. So the size has changed dramatically. I think the focus also has shifted. When the Institute was started, it really was to look at paleoclimate and to use an interdisciplinary approach to link between those three primary disciplines, glacial history, climate, sort of with paleoecology and archaeology. And there was a real focus on developing long time records. So not just looking at what's happening now or what might happen in the future, but going back in time and reconstructing climate through time. I'd say the emphasis now, although we still do that, the emphasis is becoming more on very short-term climate records and in predicting the future. I think there's been a shift that way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a much larger institute with many more, sort of, I'd say, a broader range of interests in it now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what do you think the Institute's most important contribution to climate science has been?
I think that would be really hard to... I think that would be really hard to pin down. Because there are so many... There are so many different interests in this institute, and I think it would be very hard to pick one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure. You mentioned that when talking about your own contributions, that really what they deal with is sea level change. That's I guess what I'm curious about is, within the scientific community, the human role in climate change is pretty well established. But it seems that outside the scientific community, people are still debating that. And I'm wondering if you can comment as to why that might be the case.
Well, I don't think scientists have always made a good case or a good... Excuse me. I don't think that scientists have always made a good case for their argument about why humans are involved in causing climate change now. In part, that may be a lack of good communication. In part, it may be because so many scientists see it as so obvious that they don't make as much of an effort to communicate it as possible, I guess. And in part, I think some of it may have to do with the public's perception of science, really, or lack of understanding, perhaps, of what science is. And you know, the idea that usually, anyway, science is based on very careful observation and testing of ideas, which have to be replicated multiple times before people... reach a consensus that's what's the, you know, what's the most likely hypothesis. Science tends to be fairly conservative for the most part, which is, I think, something that's not appreciated by the public at all. It generally takes a long time to change an idea in science. But yeah, I think a lot of it is communication, and then unfortunately it's become a political argument, and so if you're in one party you're against the idea, if you're in another party you're for the idea, and I think a lot of people really haven't looked necessarily at the evidence and instead are following one party or the other.
Should the Climate Change Institute play a role in educating the public about climate change?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think it's a natural thing for the Institute to do. And we do that quite a bit. Primarily, well, the thing I see the most perhaps are the school groups that come through and see the different things that we're doing and learn about the type of work we do and climate change. And I mean, I think we could do that a lot more as well.
How often does that happen?
The school groups?
Mm-hmm.
Several times a year. I don't know how often, in part because I'm not here for large chunks of the year, but several times a year. And also I know lots of us actually go into the classroom and talk. I go into elementary school classrooms and talk about climate and Antarctica and things like that. I know lots of people
sure.
in the department do that.
Where have you gone?
Well, my kids are in sort of the East Core of the school system, since I've been in that. And my sister also teaches in Southern Maine, so I go down there as well. And I've been in Old Town and a few other places as well.
Yeah. Is it difficult, as a mother, is it difficult, because you're a mother, but you're also a scientist, and so you go out in the field and being away for maybe a couple of months at a time?
Yeah, no, that's the hardest part of my job.
Yeah, perhaps even more difficult than the challenging terrain.
Oh yeah, no, that's fine. It's the leaving. It's not even when you're away. It's not so bad because you're busy. But it's the actual act of leaving. The getting on the plane. Until you actually get there and get busy. That's the hardest part of my job.
What's the longest you were ever away from home?
So before I had kids, I used to go regularly from about the 1st of October until mid-February in the Antarctic. So I guess that's about 4 months or so.
And now?
Couple months.
Couple months.
Yeah. Yeah. I've tried to have shorter seasons. I have more seasons than I used to have because I don't work just in the Antarctic now, but I've tried to have shorter seasons. This particular year, I ended up having two projects going at once, and so I had a month for each project.
Mm-hmm.
So,
How do you see the Institute changing and evolving into the future?
To be honest, that's not something I spend a lot of time thinking about. But I think it's going to continue to broaden. And I think that we probably will continue down this track of moving more perhaps towards short-term records and maybe even more towards policy, towards advising lawmakers or other people as far as how climate might affect their policy decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's an area we probably will move more into in the future.
I see. Well, that's all the questions I have for now, but before we conclude the interview, I do want to give you a chance to maybe add something that I didn't think to ask you about.
No, actually, I think you've done quite a thorough job.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I don't have anything else to add.
Okay. So. Well, thank you for participating in this interview.
Well, thank you.
All right, I'll go ahead and stop it now.